will certainly merge the two companies together, and there will be one combined news operation.
Alaska Dispatch buys the Anchorage Daily News. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, will Russia continue being a good neighbor in the Arctic?
Should the Ukraine crisis escalate, I think it's clear there will be some spillover effect, which will impact the Arctic.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Alaska Dispatch is making an aggressive move to position itself at the forefront of the state's media landscape. It announced today that it's buying the Anchorage Daily News, Alaska's largest newspaper. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
The $34 million deal between Alaska Dispatch Publishing and the California-based McClatchy Company, which currently owns the 68-year-old Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper, was signed this morning. Tony Hopfinger is the executive editor of Alaska Dispatch.
The whole idea behind this is to develop a much more comprehensive news product than what Alaska Dispatch or the Anchorage Daily News offer now that reaches all of Alaska.
Hopfinger says he hasn't spoken to Anchorage Daily News employees yet, and future changes to the staffing and structure of the company are uncertain.
We will certainly merge the two companies together, and there will be one combined news operation. We can say that there will be one news website, but when that's up and running and happens, I don't know yet, and the paper will continue 7 days a week.
Hopfinger says with the combined newsrooms, the goal will be for the Dispatch to delve into issues on a broader statewide level.
That's the first thing you'll notice, is that we'll have more people in a larger, healthier newsroom. And then we're also looking at trying to eventually get more people positioned in other bureaus around the state.
He says the Dispatch has been looking for ways to improve its product and reach more Alaskans. And after tracking newspaper sales in the lower 48, the Dispatch reached out to McClatchy in August last year.
When we saw the Boston Globe and the Washington Post sell, and other newspapers, frankly, last year, it began to occur to us that there might be an opportunity here in Anchorage to combine forces and create a more comprehensive journalism operation.
The sale is expected to be finalized in early May. Calls to the Anchorage Daily News were not returned by deadline. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Pro-Russian activists seized public buildings in eastern Ukraine this week, and U.S. officials say they suspect the actions were not spontaneous, but engineered by Russia. That, combined with Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's recent annexation of Crimea, has Arctic experts wondering what this means for international relations in the Arctic and if the era of cooperation with Russia is over. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Despite occasional fears from the West of a Russian land grab in the Arctic, Russia has behaved as a good neighbor with other countries in the Arctic Council. It led the way to treaties on search and rescue, for instance, in effect pledging its mighty fleet of icebreakers to help its neighbors. But sometimes, Russia shows a harsher face. That's Vladimir Putin in December telling his top military officers they should pay special attention to building installations in the Arctic. He told them Russia will be stepping up development in the region and must have all the levers for the protection of its security and national interests. This week, Putin also instructed his security forces to beef up the Arctic frontier. Russia watchers in Washington say there are signs that whatever its intentions in Ukraine, Russia might remain a good neighbor in the Arctic. The best sign is the meeting of the Arctic Council late last month in Canada. The Russian delegation came as scheduled, even as Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper was criticizing Russian aggression in Crimea and demanding its expulsion from the G8. Charles Ebinger, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, says his contacts within the U.S. Coast Guard told him last week they're still talking to their counterparts across the Bering Strait.
I think everybody realizes it's in our own mutual interest to cooperate and not run the risk of some disastrous sea accident just because of the broader international difficulties.
In the big picture, Ebinger says Putin must realize he can't develop his petroleum assets in the Arctic without the help of American or Western European oil companies. On the other hand, Ebinger says he expects an emboldened Putin will press for territory beyond Ukraine. That, he says, will trigger tougher sanctions against Russia, and the spirit of cooperation in the Arctic is likely to be crushed by a grimmer mood in Moscow. Heather Conley, director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, says it's unclear if cooperation can continue in the Arctic.
I think right now everyone is walking very carefully.
Conley says Russia and the other Arctic nations still have a strong interest in maintaining their good working relationships.
But I think we do recognize that should the Ukraine crisis escalate, I think it's clear there will be some spillover effect, which will impact the Arctic.
Already, the U.S. and Norway have called off a naval exercise with Russia in the Arctic. That's outside the realm of the Arctic Council, but such exercises do help the countries develop joint rescue plans and pollution control operations. Robert Hubert, associate director of the Center for Military and Strategic Studies in Calgary, says he expects Russia to continue to play nice in the Arctic for the time being, either because they still believe in the cooperative alliance or because they want to make their actions in Crimea look like an isolated incident. Hubert says it presents a puzzle for Western nations.
On the one hand, it's also in their interest to have the Arctic remain outside of all of this. But if the Russians have become more assertive, more aggressive, there is a requirement to stand up to it.
As Hubert sees it, Russia has touched off a national security chain reaction that is likely to spread north, because Putin's takeover of Crimea has both Sweden and Finland feeling they might be next. That has revived their interest in joining NATO. If either country becomes a full member, Hubert says Russia would take it as a direct military threat, an attempt by NATO to encircle the Arctic.
The Russians, since about 2004, 2005, have always listed one of their core security threats to what they perceive as their security is an expansion of NATO onto its doorsteps.
Hubert acknowledges his perspective on Russia tends to be darker than most, but he never really believed in Russia, the nice Arctic neighbor. Hubert says the Arctic Council experience only proves that countries can cooperate to set up a framework for cooperation.
I don't know if you have kids, but it's always easy to get the kids to agree to all the rules about sharing toys until the actual toy shows up.
The real test, Hubert says, comes when the Arctic Council stands between Russia and something it wants. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the tricky problem of closing Alaska's gender pay gap.
What does it mean for Alaska's economy? And what does it mean for women in Alaska that, in general, they have less money than men do?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
President Obama today signed executive orders that aim to tighten the pay gap between men and women. The president's actions take place on National Equal Pay Day, a day symbolizing how long women have to work into 2014 to catch up with what men earned in 2013. Equal Pay Day originated in 1996 to raise public awareness of the wage gap. While discrimination may contribute to Alaska's pay gap, a state economist says other factors are just as important. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports.
An Alaska statute prohibits employers from paying females less than males for the same work. But for every dollar a man in Alaska earns, a woman earns roughly 67 cents. State labor economist Caroline Schultz says occupation and industry selection is the main reason behind the pay gap.
Women are never going to earn as much as men if women don't choose to pursue high-paying occupations.
Engineers make some of the highest salaries in the state, but only 18% of them are women. They're making on average $72,000 a year, while their male counterparts make close to $96,000. Supervisors in oil, mining, and construction industries also make high salaries. Only 5% of them are women, and on average, they earn less than half of men in the same position. These 2012 figures from the Department of Labor represent total annual earnings and don't distinguish between full and part-time work. Schultz says work flexibility is another factor in the gender pay gap. Alaska has a predominance of jobs in natural resources, and those often take place in remote work sites.
That can sometimes be more of a challenge to women because women traditionally take on a larger burden when it comes to family care. So, you know, if they need to leave early to pick up the kid from school, a woman's more likely to take a flexible job, maybe that pays a little bit less than a man is.
Tamaya Liebersbach is the Women's Economic Empowerment Center coordinator for YWCA Alaska. She says discrimination is a contributing factor to the pay gap, even if it's not done on purpose.
Some sort of idea that maybe a woman isn't as committed to her career, she has a family, those kinds of stereotypes do play a role, I think, in not just the wage that a woman gets, but the opportunities that she's given to build her career.
YWCA Alaska will host a Women's Economic Empowerment Summit for the first time on May 5th, Alaska's Equal Pay Day. The summit includes a session on the art of negotiation. Wage disparity is also a focus of the Alaska Women's Summit, established last year after Senator Liesl McGuire commissioned a report on the status of women in Alaska. Barbara Belknap is a Juneau activist working on the issue of equal pay for women. She's also an Alaska delegate to Vision 2020, a national coalition focused on women's economic and social equality. Belknap says negotiating salary is one way for women to take the matter of pay disparity into their own hands.
Before you go into the interview, understand what the pay scale is for what you're applying for. You know what the going rate is. Do some research.
A couple of years ago, Belknap made a YouTube video demonstrating how to successfully negotiate pay. Through the video, Belknap is spreading a message she never got. She says it never occurred to her to negotiate salary when she was appointed executive director of Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute in 1997.
They said, well, we were paying your predecessor too much money, so your salary is going to be this much money. And I remember the little thought bubble in my head going, oh, really? You know, really? But I didn't say anything.
Belknap received pay increases over time, but says her starting salary was $8,000 less than the starting salary of her male predecessor. State economist Schultz says whatever the reasons may be for the pay gap, the result is the same. Women have less money.
At the end of the year, at the end of a lifespan, like at an end of a career, women have earned less money consistently through 25, 30, 35 years of working. And that really adds up.
And this fact, Schultz says, leads to other questions.
What does it mean for Alaska's economy? And what does it mean for women in Alaska that in general they have less money than men do? How does that affect their spending? How does that affect childcare? How does it affect children?
Schultz doesn't know the answers to these questions. She also doesn't know what happens in corporate offices during salary talks. But as an economist, she'll continue to collect and present the data that could lead to decreasing Alaska's pay gap. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
A constitutional amendment that would reconfigure a commission tasked with vetting judges was pulled from a vote in the Alaska Senate on Monday and then again today after struggling to pick up the necessary support. Under Senate Joint Resolution 21, the governor's public appointees on the Judicial Council would outnumber the attorney members 2-1. It would also require the attorney members be confirmed by the legislature. Senator Pete Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, has pitched it as a way to add more rural members to the council and increase public oversight of judicial selection. In recent years, the Judicial Council has been a political target for conservative advocacy groups that are unhappy with the way the courts have ruled on abortion cases. The resolution needs approval from two-thirds of the legislature. Senator Liesl McGuire, who chairs the Rules Committee tasked with scheduling the measure, says it's not quite there yet. Enough urban Democrats and moderate Republicans have registered opposition to the amendment to keep it from going through.
It's a question about whether the votes are there for sure.
The measure has been rescheduled for tomorrow's calendar to give Kelly the chance to secure another yes vote. The Alaska House of Representatives passed a sweeping education bill last night, but only after removing some of its more contentious elements and adding another pot of education funding. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
At the stroke of midnight, the House voted in favor of an education bill that nobody seemed particularly excited about. It gave schools too much money, said Eagle River Republican Laura Reinbold in her closing remarks.
I'm concerned that this isn't sustainable.
It gave them too little money, argued Anchorage Democrat Guarantor.
The bill in front of us now will lead to additional cuts.
It did not hold schools accountable enough, as Chickaloon Republican Eric Feige believed.
I think the educational institutions in this state should be coming to us and proving to us what they're returning on our investment.
But in the end, a large majority of the House agreed with Anchorage Republican Craig Johnson.
I will not sacrifice the good for the perfect. I will not say no to something that takes us forward, even if it's baby steps.
The final vote was 28-11, and the split was largely on caucus lines. Jonathan Christ Tompkins of Sitka was the lone minority Democrat who voted in favor of the bill. Mark Newman of Big Lake and Tammy Wilson of North Pole were the only Republicans to vote against it. The bill was introduced by Governor Sean Parnell as the marquee legislation to what he has dubbed the education session. Included in its 60-odd sections are provisions that encourage vocational education, set up a grant program for new charter schools, and allow students to earn credit for testing out of classes. But the two farthest-reaching components of the legislation were not part of the governor's original bill. They were additions the House Finance Committee made last week, and neither survived the floor session. One restructured the teacher retirement payment plan so that the legislature would stretch out its pension obligation over time by making appropriations from the state's pool of tax revenue. Governor Sean Parnell has advocated for a nearly opposite approach that involves putting a large amount of money into the retirement trust up front, and then ideally paying pensions out over a shorter timeline with the help of investment earnings. Representative Kathy Munoz, a Juneau Republican, successfully brought forward an amendment wiping the bill free of all changes to the retirement system. During her floor speech, she noted the plan included in the bill would stretch out retirement payments an extra 40 years and cost the state $15 billion more than Parnell's plan, according to an actuarial analysis.
The risk of continuing to balloon the unfunded liability is real, and in turn, the impact to our credit rating is also real.
The other major part of the bill that was scrapped dealt with the school funding formula. The House Finance Committee had tweaked the formula in a way that favored large schools, without including a similar boost for small ones. Representative Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham Democrat who caucuses with the majority, offered an amendment restoring the original formula. He said the formula change had not been properly vetted. He also framed the amendment as a matter of fairness, acknowledging that while the urban schools need money,
I argue that so do the smaller schools.
Edgman's amendment also added $30 million in one-time school funding to the bill. That's in addition to an increase to the base student allocation that's worth $225 million over 3 years. By comparison, the governor proposed increasing per-student funding by $100 million over that same time period. While some Democrats in the minority said the funding package on the table was better than nothing, it still did not go far enough for most. As a caucus, they offered a failed amendment that would have put $450 million toward the base student allocation, stretched over 3 years. Democrats also attempted to get rid of language in the bill forbidding the state from spending money to implement Common Core standards, which they noted resembled Alaska's own standards. They also tried to limit a new tax credit so it would only cover contributions made to public schools, not private ones. None of their amendments were successful. The bill will now be sent to the Senate. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The state will take another look at its cleanup standard for sulfalane-contaminated water in North Pole. Last November, the Department of Environmental Conservation set a 14 parts per billion cleanup threshold for groundwater tainted by historic spills at the Flint Hills North Pole refinery. The company objected, saying the number was too low and requested an adjudicatory hearing. An order issued by DEC Commissioner Larry Hartig on Friday delays a decision on the hearing, but requires an analysis and explanation of how the standard was reached. DEC Spill Prevention and Response Division Director Kristen Ryan says the figure resulted from a collaboration with the Environmental Protection Agency.
There's a lot of science that went into that number. We just didn't do an adequate job, in the commissioner's opinion, of defending, of proving that we had done the right research and that our number was the right number to choose instead of the one Flint Hills proposed. So we just need to explain ourselves better.
Using the same study the EPA and state based its number on, Flint Hills hired an environmental contractor who came up with a cleanup threshold 25 times higher. The DEC's Ryan attributes the large spread between the two figures to different responses to a fundamental question.
Where do you start your process of determining toxicity? And EPA and SPAR, my division, picked an endpoint of no observable adverse effects in rats. And the Flint Hills numbers did not. They picked a number that wasn't at the no observable adverse effect point.
The observable adverse effects in rats include decreased white blood cell counts and liver impacts. But Ryan says it's a less than clear-cut process in determining how those results translate to the situation in North Pole. The sulfalane impact research is based on short-term exposure in rats, and Ryan says that requires applying uncertainty factors.
Say, well, we don't know what the impacts of sulfalane would be if there was chronic exposure. We don't know what the impacts of sulfalane would be on humans. We don't know if a child who ingests more water per body weight than an adult, we don't know if they would have a different reaction. So we added a safety factor for that.
Ryan's division is charged with analyzing and better explaining its number. She says that process will include going over the study information again, plus examining what Flint Hills has provided and whatever new research might be out there. She says establishing the sulfalane cleanup threshold is a top priority, but there's no deadline for it. Flint Hills will have the ability to appeal whatever number the state sets. Students from across the state competed in the 26th annual Alaska State Geographic Bee last week in hopes of winning a spot in this year's national competition in Washington, D.C. 101 students vied for the spot. APRN intern Jolene Almendarez attended the final round of competition and has this story.
Jonathan Gray Harver, called Gray by his friends, stood in front of a small audience at the Egan Center and answered the first of many final round questions.
Why Maya Canyon? Known as the Grand Canyon of the Pacific, is located on the island of Kauai in which state?
Hawaii.
Correct.
Gray is a 7th grade student from Kodiak Middle School. Later, he faced off against 7th grader Patrick Antonovich from Anchorage. He bested his opponent by one question and says he felt confident about the contest.
I actually wasn't nervous. Not overly. I was a little bit in the finals, but I've done things like this before. I wrestle, I do cross country, I do all this stuff. But this was different. This was something that I felt confident that I could do.
If Gray wins the national competition, he'll score a $50,000 scholarship and lifetime National Geographic membership. But win or lose, he plans to compete again next year because he says geography is important.
I've always liked the subject. But geography is important because you got to know where things are, and if you hear something on the news about something happening somewhere, it's good to know where that is so you're not sitting there going, where the heck is that?
A 2006 study found that only 40% of Americans between 18 and 23 years old could locate Iraq on a map of the Middle East, and only a third could locate Louisiana, even after Hurricane Katrina. Moderator Brian Ross says it's important to teach geography in public schools.
How can you change the world if you don't know anything about the world? So that's why I think geography is important. It's more than just places and names of countries. It's about, well, if you listen to some of these questions, they actually talked about museums. They talked about historical events. They talked about why is this place important. So it's not just the where, it's the why.
Gray is representing Alaska in the National Geographic Bee in Washington, D.C., May 19th through 21st. The final competition is airing May 22nd at 3 p.m. Alaska time on the National Geographic Channel and Nat Geo Wild. In Anchorage, I'm Jolene Almendarez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu in Juneau and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C., and Jolene Almendarez from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with former Google Energy Policy Executive Dan Riker on Friday, May 2nd during the 2014 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dena Center. Hear how Alaska can become a world leader in the fast-growing renewable energy industry. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.